Committee will come to order.
Good morning, everyone. This is the third in a series of public hearings the committee will be holding as part of the House of Representatives impeachment inquiry. Without objection, the chair is authorized to declare a recess of the committee at any time. There is a quorum present. We will proceed today in the same fashion as our first hearing. I will make an opening statement, and then Ranking Member Nunes will have the opportunity to make a statement. Then we will turn to our witnesses for their opening statements and then to questions. For audience members, we welcome you and respect your interest in being here. In turn, we ask for your respect as we proceed with today's hearing. It is the intention of the committee to proceed without disruptions. As chairman, I'll take all necessary and appropriate steps to maintain order and ensure that the committee is run in accordance with House rules and House Resolution 660. With that, I now recognize myself to give an opening statement in the impeachment inquiry into Donald J. Trump, the 45th President of the United States. Last week, we heard from three experienced diplomats who testified about President Trump's scheme to condition official acts, a White House meeting, and hundreds of millions of dollars of U.S. military aid to fight the Russians on a deliverable by the new Ukrainian President Zelensky, two politically motivated investigations that Trump believed would help his reelection campaign. One of those investigations involved the Bidens, and the other involved a discredited conspiracy theory that Ukraine and not Russia was responsible for interfering in our 2016 election. As Ambassador Sondland would later tell career Foreign Service Officer David Holmes immediately after speaking to the president, Trump did not give a, he then used an expletive, about Ukraine. He cares about big stuff that benefits the president, like the Biden investigation that Giuliani was pushing. To press a foreign leader to announce an investigation into his political rival, President Trump put his own personal and political interests above those of the nation. He undermined our military and diplomatic support for a key ally and undercut U.S. anti-corruption efforts in Ukraine. How could our diplomats urge Ukraine to refrain from political investigations of its own citizens if the President of the United States was urging Ukraine to engage in precisely the same kind of corrupt and political investigations of one of our own citizens? At the White House, career professionals became concerned that President Trump, through an irregular channel that involved his acting chief of staff, Mick Mulvaney, EU Ambassador Gordon Sondland, and Rudy Giuliani, was pushing a policy towards Ukraine at odds with the national interest. This morning, we hear from two of the national security professionals who became aware of those efforts. Lieutenant Colonel Alex Vindman, whose family fled oppression in the Soviet Union when he was a toddler, is a career Army officer, an Iraq War veteran who was awarded a Purple Heart, and an expert in Russia and Ukraine who has worked at the highest levels of the Pentagon. In July 2018, he was detailed to the White House in part to coordinate policy on Ukraine. Jennifer Williams is a career Foreign Service officer who is currently detailed to the Office of the Vice President and responsible for Europe and Eurasia-related issues. Following his initial and congratulatory phone call with Ukrainian President Zelensky on April 21st, President Trump asked Vice President Pence to represent him at Zelensky's upcoming inauguration. Ms. Williams was working on logistics for the trip. Pence would be a coveted attendee, second in significance only to the president, and would have sent an important signal of support to the new Ukrainian president. In early May, however, Rudy Giuliani had been planning to go to Ukraine to pursue the president's interest in having the Bidens investigated, but had to call off the trip after it became public. Among others, Giuliani blamed people around Zelensky for having to cancel and claimed that they were antagonistic to Trump. 3 days later, the president called off the vice president's attendance at Zelensky's inauguration. Instead, a lower-level delegation was named, Energy Secretary Rick Perry, Ambassador Sondland, and Ambassador Kurt Volker, the three amigos. Senator Ron Johnson and Lieutenant Colonel Vindman would also attend. After returning from the inauguration, several members of the delegation briefed President Trump on their encouraging first interactions with Zelensky. They urged Trump to meet with the Ukrainian president, but Trump instead criticized Ukraine and instructed them to work with Rudy. A few weeks later, On July 10th, Ambassador Sondland met at the White House with a group of U.S. and Ukrainian officials, including Colonel Vindman, and informed the group that according to Chief of Staff Mulvaney, the White House meeting sought by the Ukrainian president with Trump would happen if Ukraine undertook certain investigations. National Security Advisor Bolton abruptly ended the meeting and said afterwards that he would not be part of whatever drug deal Sondland and Mulvaney are cooking up on this. Undeterred, Sondland brought the Ukrainian delegation downstairs to another part of the White House and was more explicit, according to witnesses. Ukraine needed to investigate the Bidens or Burisma if they were to get a White House meeting with Trump. After this discussion, which Vindman witnessed, he went to the National Security Council's top lawyer to report the matter. Vindman was told to return in the future with any concerns. He would soon find the need to do so. A week later, on July 18th, the representative of the Office of Management and Budget announced on a video conference call that Mulvaney, at Trump's direction, was freezing nearly $400 million in military assistance to Ukraine, which was appropriated by Congress and enjoyed the support of the entirety of the U.S. national security establishment. And one week after that, Trump would have the now infamous July 25th phone call with Zelensky. During that call, Trump complained that the U.S. relationship with Ukraine had not been reciprocal. Later, Zelensky thanks Trump for his support in the area of defense and says that Ukraine was ready to purchase more javelins, an anti-tank weapon that was among the most important deterrents of further Russian military action. Trump's immediate response, "I would like you to do us a favor, though." Trump then requested that Zelensky investigate the discredited 2016 conspiracy theory and, even more ominously, look into the Bidens. Neither was part of the official preparatory material for the call, but they were in Donald Trump's personal interest and in the interests of his 2020 re-election campaign. And the Ukrainian president knew about both in advance because Sondland and others had been pressing Ukraine for weeks about investigations into the 2016 election, Burisma, and the Bidens. Both Colonel Vindman and Ms. Williams were on the July 25th call. Vindman testified that due to the unequal bargaining position of the two leaders and Ukraine's dependency on the U.S., the favor Trump asked of Zelensky was really a demand. After the call, multiple individuals, including Vindman, were concerned enough to report it to the National Security Council's top lawyer. It was the second time in 2 weeks that Vindman had raised concerns with NSC lawyers. For her part, Williams also believed that asking Zelensky to undertake these political investigations was inappropriate, and that it might explain something else that she'd become aware of, the otherwise inexplicable hold on U.S. military assistance to Ukraine. Both Colonel Vindman and Ms. Williams also took note of the explicit use of the word Burisma by Zelensky, a fact conspicuously left out of the record of the call, now locked away on an ultra-secure server. Colonel Vindman believed that Zelensky must have been prepped for the call to be able to make the connection between Biden and Burisma, a fact that other witnesses have now confirmed. In the weeks that followed the July 25th call, Colonel Vindman continued to push for a release of the military aid to Ukraine and struggled to learn why it was being withheld. More disturbing, word of the hold had reached Ukrainian officials prior to it becoming public. By mid-August, the Ukrainian deputy ambassador asked Vindman why the United States was withholding the aid. Although Vindman didn't have an answer, Sondland made it explicit to Ukrainians at a meeting in Warsaw. They needed to publicly commit to these two investigations if they hoped to get the aid. Ms. Williams, we all saw the president's tweet about you on Sunday afternoon and the insults he hurled at Ambassador Yovanovitch last Friday. You are here today, and the American people are grateful. Colonel Vindman, we have seen far more scurrilous attacks on your character and watched as certain personalities on Fox have questioned your loyalty. I note that you have shed blood for America, and we owe you an immense debt of gratitude. I hope no one on this committee will become part of those vicious attacks. Today's witnesses, like those who testified last week, are here because they were subpoenaed to appear, not because they are for or against impeachment. That question is for Congress, not the fact witnesses. If the president abused his power and invited foreign interference in our elections, if he sought to condition, coerce, extort, or bribe an ally into conducting investigations, to aid his reelection campaign and did so by withholding official acts, a White House meeting, or hundreds of millions of dollars of needed military aid, it will be up to us to decide whether those acts are compatible with the office of the presidency. I now recognize Ranking Member Nunes for any remarks he'd like to make.
Thanks, gentlemen. I'd like to address a few brief words to the American people watching at home. If you watched the impeachment hearings last week, you may have noticed a disconnect between what you actually saw and the mainstream media accounts describing it. When you saw three diplomats who dislike President Trump's Ukraine policy discussing second-hand and third-hand conversations about their objections with the Trump policy. Meanwhile, they admitted they had not talked to the president about these matters, and they were unable to identify any crime or impeachable offense the president committed. But what you read in the press were accounts of shocking, damning, and explosive testimony that fully supports the Democrats' accusations. If these accounts have a familiar ring, it's because this is the same preposterous reporting the media offered for 3 years on the Russian hoax. On a nearly daily basis, the top news outlets in America reported breathlessly on the newest bombshell revelations showing that President Trump and everyone surrounding him were Russian agents. It really wasn't long ago that we were reading these headlines from CNN: Congress investigating Russian investment fund with ties to Trump officials. This was false. New York Times: Trump campaign aides had repeated contacts with Russian intelligence. Also false. Slate: was a Trump server communicating with Russia. This was false. New York Magazine: will Trump be meeting with his counterpart or his handler? This was false. The Guardian: Manafort held secret talks with Assange in Ecuadorian embassy. Also false. BuzzFeed: President Trump directed his attorney to lie to Congress about the Moscow Tower project. All of these were false. There was no objectivity or fairness in the media's Russia stories, just as a fevered rush to tarnish and remove a president who refuses to pretend that the media are something different from what they really are: puppets of the Democratic Party. With their biased misreporting on the Russia hoax, the media lost confidence of millions of Americans, and because they refused to acknowledge how badly they botched the story, they've learned no lessons and simply expect Americans will believe them as they try to stoke yet another partisan frenzy. In previous hearings, I've outlined three questions the Democrats and the media don't want asked or answered. Instead of shedding light on these crucial questions, the media are trying to smother and dismiss them. Those questions start with: what is the full extent of the Democrats' prior coordination with the whistleblower, and who else did the whistleblower coordinate this effort with? The media have fully accepted the Democrats' stunning reversal on the need for the whistleblower to testify to this committee. When the Democrats were insisting on his testimony, the media wanted it too. But things have changed since it became clear the whistleblower would have to answer problematic questions that include these. What was the full extent of the whistleblower's prior coordination with Chairman Schiff, his staff, and any other people he cooperated with while preparing the complaint? What are the whistleblower's political biases and connections to Democratic politicians? How does the whistleblower explain the inaccuracies in the complaint? What contact did the whistleblower have with the media, which appears to be ongoing? What are the sources of the whistleblower's information? Who else did he talk to? And was the whistleblower prohibited by law from receiving or conveying any of that information? The media have joined the Democrats in dismissing the importance of cross-examining this crucial witness. Now that the whistleblower has successfully kick-started impeachment, he has disappeared from the story, as if the Democrats put the whistleblower in their own witness protection program. My second question: what was the full extent of Ukraine's election meddling against the Trump campaign? In these depositions and hearings, Republicans have cited numerous indications of Ukraine meddling in the 2016 elections to oppose the Trump campaign. Many of these instances were reported, including the posting of many primary source documents by veteran investigative journalist John Solomon. Since the Democrats switched from Russia to Ukraine for their impeachment crusade, Solomon's reporting on Burisma, Hunter Biden, and Ukraine election meddling has become inconvenient for the Democratic narrative, and so the media is furiously smearing and libeling Solomon. In fact, the publication The Hill told its staff yesterday it would conduct a review of Solomon's Ukraine reporting. Coincidentally, the decision comes just 3 days after a Democrat on this committee told a Hill writer that she would stop speaking to The Hill because it had run Solomon's stories. And she urged the writer to relay her concerns to Hill's management. So now that Solomon's reporting is a problem for the Democrats, it's a problem for the media as well. I'd like to submit for the record John Solomon's October 31st story entitled Debunking Some of Ukraine's Scandal Myths About Biden and Election Interference. I encourage viewers today to read this story and draw your own conclusions about the evidence Solomon has gathered. Ask unanimous consent that we put this into the record, Mr. Chair.
Without objection.
The concerted campaign by the media to discredit and disown some of their own colleagues is shocking. And we see it again in the sudden denunciations of New York Times reporter Ken Vogel as a conspiracy theorist after he covered similar issues, including a 2017 Politico piece entitled Ukrainian Efforts to Sabotage Trump Backfire. My third question, why did Burisma hire Hunter Biden? What did he do for them? And did his position affect any U.S. government actions under the Obama administration? We have now heard testimony from the Democrats' own witnesses that diplomats were concerned about a conflict of interest involving Hunter Biden. That's because he had secured a well-paid position, despite having no qualifications, on the board of a corrupt Ukrainian company, while his father was vice president charged with overseeing Ukrainian issues. After trying out several different accusations against President Trump, the Democrats have recently settled on bribery. According to widespread reports, they replaced their quid pro quo allegation because it wasn't polling well. But if the Democrats and the media are suddenly so deeply concerned about bribery, you would think they would take some interest in Burisma paying Hunter Biden $83,000 a month. And you think they would be interested in Joe Biden threatening to withhold U.S. loan guarantees unless the Ukrainians fired a prosecutor who was investigating Burisma. That would be a textbook example of bribery. The media, of course, are free to act as Democrat puppets, and they're free to lurch from the Russia hoax to the Ukraine hoax at the direction of their puppet masters. But they cannot reasonably expect to do so without alienating half the country who voted for the president they're trying to expel. Americans have learned to recognize fake news when they see it, and if the mainstream press won't give it to them straight, they'll go elsewhere to find it, which is exactly what the American people are doing. That I yield back.
I thank the gentleman. Today we are joined by Lieutenant Colonel Vindman and Jennifer Williams. Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman is an active duty military officer who joined the Army after college and served multiple tours overseas, serving in South Korea, Germany, and Iraq. He was deployed to Iraq at a time of heavy fighting and was awarded a Purple Heart after being wounded by a roadside bomb. Since 2008, Colonel Vindman has served as a foreign area officer specializing in Eurasia, serving both at home and in U.S. embassies in Ukraine and Russia. He has served as a politico-military affairs officer for Russia for the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He joined the Trump administration in July 2018 when he was asked to serve on the National Security Council. Jennifer Williams began her career in government service in 2005, shortly after graduating from college, when she joined the Department of Homeland Security as a political appointee during the George W. Bush administration, and after working as a field representative on the 2004 Bush-Cheney presidential campaign. She joined the Foreign Service the following year, completing tours in Jamaica, Beirut, and Lebanon. Prior to joining the office of the Vice President, she served at the U.S. Embassy in London as a public affairs officer. In April 2019, Ms. Williams was detailed to the office of the Vice President, Mike Pence, where she serves as a special advisor on his foreign policy team covering Europe and Russia issues. In that capacity, she keeps the Vice President aware of foreign policy issues in Europe and Russia and prepares him for foreign policy engagements and meetings with foreign leaders. Two final points before witnesses are sworn. First, witness depositions as part of this inquiry were unclassified in nature, and all open hearings will also be held at the unclassified level. Any information that may touch on classified information will be addressed separately. Second, Congress will not tolerate any reprisal, threat of reprisal, or attempt to retaliate against any U.S. government official for testifying before Congress, including you or any of your colleagues. If you would both please rise and raise your right hand, I will begin by swearing you in. Do you swear or affirm that the testimony you are about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God? Let the record show the witnesses have answered in the affirmative. Thank you, and you may be seated. The microphones are sensitive, so please speak directly into them. Without objection, your written statement will be made part of the record. With that, Ms. Williams, you are now recognized for your opening statement, and when you are concluded, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, you are recognized immediately thereafter for your opening statement. Ms. Williams.
Thank you, Chairman Schiff, Ranking Member Nunes, and other members of the committee for the opportunity to provide this statement. I appear today pursuant to a subpoena and am prepared to answer your questions to the best of my abilities. I have had the privilege of working as a Foreign Service officer for nearly 14 years, working for three different presidential administrations, two Republican and one Democratic. I joined the State Department in 2006 after serving in the Department of Homeland Security under Secretary Michael Chertoff. It was with great pride and conviction that I swore an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution, administered by a personal hero of mine, former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. As a career officer, I am committed to serving the American people and advancing American interests abroad in support of the President's foreign policy objectives. I have been inspired and encouraged in that journey by the thousands of other dedicated public servants who I'm proud to call colleagues across the Foreign Service, Civil Service, military, and federal law enforcement agencies. I have served overseas tours in Kingston, Jamaica, Beirut, Lebanon, and London, United Kingdom. I have worked to implement humanitarian assistance programs to serve millions of victims of the Syria conflict, and served as an advisor on Middle East issues to the Deputy Secretary of State. And this spring, it was the greatest honor of my career to be asked to serve as a special advisor to the Vice President for Europe and Russia. Over the past 8 months, I have been privileged to work with the dedicated and capable men and women of the Office of the Vice President to advance the administration's agenda. I have also worked closely with talented and committed colleagues at the National Security Council, State Department, Department of Defense, and other agencies to advance and promote U.S. foreign policy objectives. In this capacity, I have advised and prepared the Vice President for engagements related to Ukraine. As you are aware, on November 7th, I appeared before the committee for a closed-door deposition pursuant to a subpoena. I would like to take this opportunity to briefly summarize my recollection of some of the events I expect the committee may ask me about. On April 21st, Volodymyr Zelensky won the Ukrainian presidential election. On April 23rd, the Vice President called to congratulate President-elect Zelensky. During the call, which I participated in, the Vice President accepted an invitation to attend President-elect Zelensky's upcoming inauguration, providing that the scheduling worked out. The Vice President had only a narrow window of availability at the end of May, and the Ukrainian Parliament would not meet to set a date for the inauguration until after May 14th. As a result, we did not expect to know whether the Vice President could attend until May 14th at the earliest, and we made only preliminary trip preparations in early May. On May 13th, an assistant to the Vice President's Chief of Staff called and informed me that President Trump had decided that the Vice President would not attend the inauguration in Ukraine. She did not provide any further explanation. I relayed that instruction to others involved in planning the potential trip. I also informed the NSC that the Vice President would not be attending so that it could identify a head of delegation to represent the United States at President-elect Zelensky's inauguration. On July 3rd, I learned that the Office of Management and Budget had placed a hold on a tranche of security assistance designated for Ukraine. According to the information I received, OMB was reviewing whether the funding was aligned with the administration's priorities. I subsequently attended meetings of the Policy Coordination Committee, where the hold on Ukrainian security assistance was discussed. During those meetings, representatives of the State and Defense Departments advocated that the hold should be lifted, and OMB representatives reported that the White House Chief of Staff had directed that the hold should remain in place. On September 11th, I learned that the hold on security assistance for Ukraine had been released. I have never learned what prompted that decision. On July 25th, along with several of my colleagues, I listened to a call between President Trump and President Zelensky, the content of which has since been publicly reported. Prior to July 25th, I had participated in roughly a dozen other presidential phone calls. During my closed-door deposition, members of the committee asked about my personal views and whether I had any concerns about the July 25th call. As I testified then, I found the July 25th phone call unusual because, in contrast to other presidential calls I had observed, it involved discussion of what appeared to be a domestic political matter. After the July 25th call, I provided an update in the Vice President's daily briefing book indicating that President Trump had a call that day with President Zelensky. A hard copy of the memorandum transcribing the call was also included in the book. I do not know whether the Vice President reviewed my update or the transcript. I did not discuss the July 25th call with the Vice President or any of my colleagues in the Office of the Vice President or the NSC. On August 29th, I learned that the Vice President would be traveling to Poland to meet with President Zelensky on September 1st. At the September 1st meeting, which I attended, President Zelensky asked the Vice President about news articles reporting a hold on U.S. security assistance for Ukraine. The Vice President responded that Ukraine had the United States' unwavering support and promised to relay their conversation to President Trump that night. During the September 1st meeting, neither the Vice President nor President Zelensky mentioned the specific investigations discussed during the July 25th phone call. Thank you again for the opportunity to provide this statement. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chairman, ranking members, thank you for the opportunity to address the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence with respect to the activities relating to Ukraine and my role in the events under investigation. I've dedicated my entire professional life to the United States of America. For more than two decades, it has been my honor to serve as an officer in the United States Army. As an infantry officer, I served multiple overseas tours, including South Korea and Germany, and I was deployed to Iraq for combat operations. Since 2008, I have been a foreign area officer specializing in European and Eurasian political and military affairs. I served in the United States embassies in Kiev, Ukraine, and Moscow, Russia. In Washington, D.C., I was the political military affairs officer for Russia, for the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, where I drafted the Armed Forces Global Campaign Plan to counter Russian aggression and Russian malign influence. In July 2018, I was asked to serve at the White House National Security Council. At the NSC, I'm the principal advisor to the National Security Advisor on Ukraine and other countries in my portfolio. My role at the NSC is to develop, coordinate, and implement plans and policies to manage the full range of diplomatic, informational, military, and economic national security issues for the country in my portfolio. My core function is to coordinate policy with departments and agencies. The committee has heard from many of my colleagues about the strategic importance of Ukraine as a bulwark against Russian aggression. It is important to note that our country's policy of supporting Ukrainian sovereignty and territorial integrity, promoting Ukrainian prosperity, and strengthening a free and democratic Ukraine as a counter to Russian aggression has been a consistent bipartisan foreign policy objective and strategy across various administrations, both Democratic and Republican, and that President Zelensky's election in April 2019 created an unprecedented opportunity to realize our strategic objectives. In the spring of 2019, I became aware of two disruptive actors, primarily Ukraine's then-prosecutor Yuri Lutsenko and former Mayor Rudolf Giuliani, President's personal attorney, promoting false narratives that undermined the United States-Ukraine policy. The NSC and its interagency partners, including the State Department, grew increasingly concerned about the impact that such information was having on our country's ability to achieve our national security objectives. On April 21, 2019, Volodymyr Zelensky was elected President of Ukraine in a landslide victory on a unity, reform, and anti-corruption platform. President Trump called President Zelensky on April 21, 2019, to congratulate him on his victory. I was the staff officer who produced the call materials and was one of the staff officers who listened to the call. The call was positive, and President Trump expressed his desire to work with President Zelensky and extended an invitation to visit the White House. In May, I attended the inauguration of President Zelensky as part of the presidential delegation led by Secretary Perry. Following the visit, the members of the delegation provided President Trump a debriefing offering a positive assessment of President Zelensky and his team. After this debriefing, President Trump signed a congratulatory letter to President Zelensky and extended another invitation to visit the White House. On July 10, 2019, Alexander Danyluk, then Ukraine's National Security Advisor, visited Washington, D.C. for a meeting with National Security Advisor Bolton. Ambassadors Volker and Sondland and Secretary Rick Perry also attended the meeting. I attended with Dr. Hill. We fully anticipated the Ukrainians would raise the issue of a meeting between the presidents. Ambassador Bolton cut the meeting short when Ambassador Sondland started to speak about the requirement that Ukraine deliver specific investigations in order to secure the meeting with President Trump. Following this meeting, there was a short debriefing during which Ambassador Sondland emphasized the importance of Ukraine delivering the investigations into the 2016 elections, the Bidens, and Burisma. I stated to Ambassador Sondland that this was inappropriate and had nothing to do with national security. Dr. Hill also asserted his comments when proper. Following the meeting, Dr. Hill and I agreed to report the incident to NSC's lead counsel, Mr. John Eisenberg. On July 21, 2019, President Zelensky won a parliamentary election in another landslide victory. The NSC proposed that President Trump call President Zelensky to congratulate him. On July 25, 2019, the call occurred. I listened on the call in the Situation Room with White House colleagues. I was concerned by the call. What I heard was inappropriate, and I reported my concerns to Mr. Eisenberg. It is improper for the President of the United States to demand a foreign government investigate a U.S. citizen and a political opponent. I was also clear that if Ukraine pursued an investigation, into the 2016 elections, the Bidens and Burisma, it would be interpreted as a partisan play. This would undoubtedly result in Ukraine losing bipartisan support, undermining U.S. national security, and advancing Russia's strategic objectives in the region. I want to emphasize to the committee that when I reported my concerns on July 10th relating to Ambassador Sondland and on July 25th relating to the President, I did so out of a sense of duty. I privately reported my concerns in official channels to the proper authority in the chain of command. My intent was to raise these concerns because they had significant national security implications for our country. I never thought that I'd be sitting here testifying in front of this committee and the American public about my actions. When I reported my concerns, my only thought was to act properly and to carry out my duty. Following each of my reports to Mr. Eisenberg, I immediately returned to work to advance the President's and our country's foreign policy objectives. I focused on what I have done throughout my military career, promoting America's national security interests. I want to take a moment to recognize the courage of my colleagues who have appeared and are scheduled to appear before this committee. I want to say that the character attacks on these distinguished and honorable public servants is reprehensible. It is natural to disagree and engage in spirited debate. This has been the custom of our country since the time of our founding fathers. But we are better than personal attacks. The uniform I wear today is that of a United States Army. The members of our all-volunteer force are made up of a patchwork of people from all ethnicities, regions, socioeconomic backgrounds, who come together under a common oath to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States of America. We do not serve any political party. We serve the nation. I am humbled to come before you today as one of many who serve in the most distinguished and able military in the world. The Army is the only profession I have ever known. As a young man, I decided I wanted to spend my life serving this nation and gave my family refuge from authoritarian oppression. For the last 20 years, it has been an honor to represent and protect this great country. Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I also recognize that my simple act of appearing here today, just like the courage of my colleagues, who have also truthfully testified before this committee, would not be tolerated in many places around the world. In Russia, my act of expressing concern to the chain of command in an official and private channel would have severe personal and professional repercussions, and offering public testimony involving the president would surely cost me my life. I'm grateful to my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Thank you, Colonel. Thank you, Ms. Williams. Colonel, your brother and family are more than welcome here. Grateful to have them with us. We will proceed to the first round of questions as detailed in the memo provided to committee members. There will be 45 minutes of questions conducted by the chairman or majority counsel, followed by 45 minutes for the ranking member or minority counsel. Under House Resolution 660, that time may not be delegated to other members. Following that, unless I specify an additional equal time for extended questioning, we will proceed under the five-minute rule, and every member will have a chance to ask questions. I now recognize myself or majority counsel for the first 45 minutes. Before we get into the substance of your testimony, Ms. Williams, I want to ask you about a phone call between Vice President Pence and President Zelensky of Ukraine on September 18th. Were you on that call?
I was.
And did you take notes of the call?
Yes, sir.
Is there something about that call that you think may be relevant to our investigation?
Mr. Chairman, as we previously discussed with the committee, the Office of the Vice President has taken the position that the September...
Could you move the microphone a little closer to you?
As we've previously discussed with both majority and minority staff of the committee, the Office of the Vice President has taken the position that the September 18th call is classified. As a result, with respect to the call, I'd refer the committee to the public record, which includes Ms. Williams' November 7th testimony, which has been publicly released, as well as the public readout of that call, which has previously been issued by the White House. Beyond that, given the position of the Vice President's office on classification, I've advised Ms. Williams not to answer further questions about that call in an unclassified setting.
Thank you, Counsel. Ms. Williams, I would only ask you in this setting whether you think there's something relevant to our inquiry in that call, and whether, if so, you'll be willing to make a classified submission to the committee.
I would also refer to my testimony that I gave in the closed session, and I'm very happy to appear for a classified setting discussion as well.
It may not be necessary for you to appear if you'll be willing to submit the information in writing to the committee.
I'd be happy to do so.
I thank you. Colonel Vindman, if I could turn your attention to the April 21st call, that is the first call between President Trump and President Zelensky. Did you prepare talking points for the president to use during that call?
Yes, I did.
And did those talking points include rooting out corruption in Ukraine?
Yes.
That was something the president was supposed to raise in the conversation with President Zelensky?
Those were the recommended talking points that were cleared through the NSC staff for the president, yes.
Did you listen in on that call?
Yes, I did.
The White House has now released the record of that call. Did President Trump ever mention corruption in the April 21st call?
To the best of my recollection, he did not.
On the April 21st call, President Trump told President Zelensky that he would send a high-level U.S. delegation to the inauguration. Following that call, Ms. Williams, was your understanding that the president wanted the vice president to attend the inauguration in Kyiv?
Yes, that was my understanding.
And did the president subsequently tell the vice president not to attend the inauguration?
I was informed by our chief of staff's office, by the vice president's chief of staff's office, that the president had told the vice president not to attend. I did not witness that conversation.
And am I correct that you learned this on May 13th? Is that right?
That's correct.
Am I also correct that the inauguration date had not been set by May 13th?
That's correct.
Do you know what accounted for the president's decision to instruct the vice president not to attend?
I do not.
Colonel Vindman, you were a member of the U.S. delegation to the inauguration on May 20th. Is that correct?
Yes, Chairman.
And during that trip, did you have an opportunity to offer any advice to President Zelensky?
Yes, Chairman.
What was the advice that you gave him?
During a bilateral meeting in which the whole delegation was meeting with President Zelensky and his team, I offered two pieces of advice: to be particularly cautious with regards to Ukraine, to be particularly cautious with regards to Russia, and its desire to provoke Ukraine. And the second one was to stay out of U.S. domestic policy.
You mean politics?
Politics, correct.
And why did you feel it was necessary to advise President Zelensky to stay away from U.S. Domestic politics?
Chairman, in the March and April time frame, became clear that there were actors in the U.S., public actors, non-governmental actors, that were promoting the idea of investigations and 2016 Ukrainian interference, and it was consistent with U.S. policy to advise any country, all the countries in my portfolio, any country in the world, to not participate in U.S. domestic politics. So I was passing the same advice consistent with U.S. policy.
I know Mr. Goldman will have more questions about that when I turn to him. But let me turn, if I can, to the hold on security assistance, which I think you both testified you learned about in early July. Am I correct that neither of you were provided with a reason for why the president put a hold on security assistance to Ukraine?
My understanding was that OMB was reviewing the assistance to ensure it was in line with administration priorities, but it was not made more specific than that.
And Colonel Vindman?
That is consistent. The review was to ensure it remained consistent with administration policies.
And Colonel Vindman, you attended a meeting in John Bolton's office on July 10th where Ambassador Sondland interjected to respond to a question by senior Ukrainian officials about a White House visit. What did he say at that time?
To the best of my recollection, Ambassador Sondland said that in order to get a White House meeting, the Ukrainians would have to provide a deliverable, which is investigations, specific investigations.
And what was Ambassador Bolton's response or reaction to that comment?
We had not completed all of the agenda items, and we still had time for the meeting, and Ambassador Bolton abruptly ended the meeting.
Did you report this incident to the National Security Council lawyers?
Yes, I did.
Based on Ambassador Sondland's remark at the July 10th meeting, was it your clear understanding that the Ukrainians understood they had to commit to investigations President Trump wanted in order to get the White House meeting?
It may have not been entirely clear at that moment. Certainly, Ambassador Sondland was calling for these meetings, and he had stated that this was developed per a conversation with the Chief of Staff, Mr. Mick Mulvaney, but the connection to the President wasn't clear at that point.
But the import of what Ambassador Sondland said during that meeting was that there was an agreement with Mick Mulvaney that Zelensky would get the meeting if they would undertake these investigations.
That is correct.
About 2 weeks after that July 10th meeting, President Trump and President Zelensky had their second call, the now infamous July 25th call. Colonel Vindman, what was your real-time reaction to hearing that call?
Chairman, without hesitation, I knew that I had to report this to the White House counsel. I had concerns, and it was my duty to report my concerns to the proper people in the chain of command.
And what was your concern?
Well, Chairman, as I said in my statement, it was improper for the President to request and to demand an investigation into a political opponent, especially a foreign power where there's at best dubious belief that this would be a completely impartial investigation and that this would have significant implications if it became public knowledge and it would be perceived as a partisan play, it would undermine our Ukraine policy, and it would undermine our national security.
Now, Colonel, you've described this as a demand, this favor that the President asked. What is it about the relationship between the President of the United States and the President of Ukraine that leads you to conclude that when the President of the United States asks a favor like this, it's really a demand?
Chairman, the culture I come from, the military culture, when a senior asks you to do something, even if it's polite and pleasant, it's not to be taken as a request. It's to be taken as an order. In this case, the power disparity between the two leaders, my impression is that in order to get the White House meeting, President Zelensky would have to deliver these investigations.
Ms. Williams, I think you described your reaction in your deposition as, when you listened to the call, as you found it unusual and inappropriate. But I was struck by something else you said in your deposition. You said that it shed some light on possible other motivations behind a security assistance hold. What did you mean by that?
Mr. Chairman, I was asked during the closed-door testimony how I felt about the call. And in reflecting on what I was thinking in that moment, it was the first time I had heard internally the President reference particular investigations that previously I had only heard about through Mr. Giuliani's press interviews in press reporting. So in that moment, it was not clear whether there was a direct connection or linkage between the ongoing hold on security assistance and what the President may be asking President Zelensky to undertake in regard to investigations. So it was noteworthy in that regard. I did not have enough information to draw any firm conclusions.
But it raised a question in your mind as to whether the two were related.
It was the first I had heard of any requests of Ukraine which were that specific in nature. So it was noteworthy to me in that regard.
Both of you recall President Zelensky in that conversation raising the issue or mentioning Burisma, do you not?
That's correct.
Correct.
And yet, the word Burisma appears nowhere in the call record that's been released to the public. Is that right?
That's right.
Correct.
Do you know why that's the case? Why that was left out?
I do not. I was not involved in the production of that transcript.
I attribute that to the fact that this transcript that is being produced may have not caught the word Burisma, and it was in the transcript that was released. It was released as the company, which is accurate. It's not a significant omission.
But Colonel, you pointed out the fact that that word was used, did you not?
Correct.
And yet it was not included in the record release to the public.
That's right. It's I'd say it's informed speculation that the folks that produce these transcripts do the best they can, and they just didn't catch the word. And that was my responsibility to then make sure that the transcript was as accurate as possible, and that's what I attempted to do by putting that word back in, because that was in my notes.
I think, Colonel, you testified in your deposition that you found it striking that Zelensky would bring up Burisma, that it indicated to you that he had been prepped for the call to expect this issue to come up. What led you to that conclusion?
It seemed unlikely that he would be familiar with a single company in the context of a call that was on the broader bilateral relationship. And it seemed to me that he was either tracking this issue because it was in the press or he was otherwise prepped.
Mr. Goldman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning to both of you.
Morning.
On July 25th at approximately 9 a.m., you both were sitting in the Situation Room, probably not too much further away than you are right now. And you were preparing for a long-awaited phone call between President Trump and President Zelensky. Now, Colonel Vindman, in advance of this phone call, did you prepare talking points as you did for the April 21st call?
Yes, I did.
What were those talking points based upon?
They were, so this is not in the public record, and I can't comment too deeply, but what is the areas that we've consistently talked about in public is cooperation on supporting his reform agenda, anti-corruption efforts, and helping President Zelensky implement his plans to end Russia's war against Ukraine.
In other words, they're based on official U.S. policy?
Correct.
And is there a process to determine official U.S. policy?
Yes, that is my job, is to coordinate U.S. policy. So throughout the preceding year that I had been on staff, I had undertaken an effort to make sure we had a cohesive, coherent U.S. policy.
And as you listened to the call, did you observe whether President Trump was following the talking points based on the official U.S. policy?
Counsel, the president could choose to use the talking points or not. He's the president, but they were not consistent with what I provided, yes.
Let's take a look at a couple of excerpts from this call. And right after President Zelensky thanked President Trump for the United States' support in the area of defense, President Trump asks President Zelensky for a favor and then raises this theory of Ukrainian interference in the 2016 election. He says in the highlighted portion, "I would like you to do us a favor, though, because our country has been through a lot and Ukraine knows a lot about it. I would like you to find out what happened with this whole situation with Ukraine. They say CrowdStrike. I guess you have one of your wealthy people, the server. They say Ukraine has it." Now, Colonel Vindman, was this statement based on the official talking points that you had prepared?
No.
And was this statement related to the 2016 Ukraine interference in the 2016 election part of the official U.S. policy
No, it was not.
Now, at the time of this July 25th call, Colonel Vindman, were you aware of a theory that Ukraine had intervened or interfered in the 2016 U.S. election?
I was.
Are you aware of any credible evidence to support this theory?
I am not.
Are you also aware that Vladimir Putin had promoted this theory of Ukrainian interference in the 2016 election?
I am well aware of that fact.
And ultimately, which country did U.S. intelligence services determine to have interfered in the 2016 election?
It is the consensus of the entire intelligence community that the Russians interfered in U.S. elections in 2016.
Let's go to another excerpt from this call, where President Trump asked President Zelensky to investigate his political opponent, Vice President Joe Biden. Here, President Trump says, the other thing, there's a lot of talk about Biden's son, that Biden stopped the prosecution, and a lot of people want to find out about that. So whatever you can do with the Attorney General would be great. Biden went around bragging that he stopped the prosecution, so if you can look into it. It sounds horrible to me, he said. Again, Colonel Vindman, was this included in your talking points?
It was not.
Is such a request to investigate a political opponent consistent with official U.S. policy?
It was not consistent with the policy as I understood it.
Now, are you aware of any credible allegations or evidence to support this notion that Vice President Biden did something wrong or against U.S. policy with regard to Ukraine?
I am not.
Ms. Williams, are you familiar with any credible evidence to support this theory against Vice President Biden?
No, I'm not.
Now, Ms. Williams, prior to the July 25th call, approximately how many calls between President of the United States and foreign leaders had you listened to?
I would say roughly a dozen.
Had you ever heard a call like this?
As I testified before, I believe what I found unusual or different about this call was the president's reference to specific investigations, and that struck me as different than other calls I had listened to.
You testified that you thought it was political in nature. Why did you think that?
I thought that the references to specific individuals and investigations, such as former Vice President Biden and his son, struck me as political in nature, given that the former Vice President is a political opponent of the President.
And so you thought that it could potentially be designed to assist President Trump's reelection effort?
I can't speak to what the President's motivation was in referencing it, but I just noted that the reference to Biden sounded political to me.
Colonel Vindman, you said in your deposition that it doesn't take a rocket scientist to see the political benefits of the president's demands. For those of us who are not rocket scientists, can you explain what you meant by that?
So my understanding is that it was the connection to investigate into a political opponent was inappropriate and improper. I made that connection as soon as the president brought up the Biden investigation.
Colonel Vindman, you testified that the President Trump's request for a favor from President Zelensky would be considered as a demand to President Zelensky. After this call, did you ever hear from any Ukrainians, either in the United States or Ukraine, about any pressure that they felt to do these investigations that President Trump demanded?
Not that I can recall.
Did you have any discussions with officials at the embassy here, the Ukrainian embassy here in Washington, D.C.?
Yes, I did.
Did you discuss at all the demand for investigations with them?
I did not.
Did you discuss at all, at any point, their concerns about the hold on security assistance?
To the best of my recollection, in the August time frame, the Ukrainian embassy started to become aware of the hold on security assistance, and they were asking if I had any comment on that or if I could substantiate that.
And that was before it became public, is that right?
Yes.
And what did you respond?
I believe I said that I don't recall, frankly. I don't recall what I said, but I believe it may have been something along the lines of I'm not aware of it.
You testified that one of your concerns about the request for investigations related to U.S. domestic politics was that Ukraine may lose bipartisan support. And why was that a concern of yours?
Ukraine is in a war with Russia, and the security assistance that we provide Ukraine is significant. Absent that security assistance, and maybe even more importantly, the signal of support for Ukrainian sovereignty and territorial integrity, that would likely encourage Russia to pursue, to potentially escalate, to pursue further aggression, further undermining Ukrainian sovereignty, European security, and U.S. security.
So, in other words, Ukraine is heavily dependent on United States support, both diplomatically, financially, and also militarily.
Correct.
Colonel Vindman, what languages do you speak?
I speak Russian and Ukrainian, and a little bit of English.
Do you recall what language President Zelensky spoke on this July 25th phone call?
I know he made a valiant effort to speak English. He'd been practicing up his English, but he also spoke Ukrainian.
I want to look at the third excerpt from the July 25th call. And Chairman Schiff addressed this with you in his questioning. And you see in the highlighted portion, it says specifically to the company that you mentioned in this issue. Is that the portion of the call record that, Colonel Vindman, you thought President Zelensky actually said Burisma?
Correct.
And you testified earlier that his use of, or his understanding that when President Trump mentioned the Bidens, that that referred to the company Burisma, sounded to you like he was prepped or prepared for this call. Is that right?
That is correct.
I want to go to the next slide, if we could, which is actually a text message that neither of you is on, but this is from Ambassador Kurt Volker to Andrei Yermak. And Colonel Vindman, who's Andrei Yermak?
Andrei Yermak is a senior advisor within the presidential administration, to Ukrainian presidential administration. He's a senior advisor to President Zelensky.
Now, this text message is less than a half hour before the call on July 25th. And since neither of you are on it, I'll read it. It says from Ambassador Volker, good lunch, thanks. Heard from White House. Assuming President Z convinces Trump he will investigate, quote, get to the bottom of what happened, unquote, in 2016, we will nail down date for visit to Washington. Good luck. See you tomorrow, Kurt. Now, is this the sort of thing that you're referring to when you say that it sounded like President Zelensky was prepared for this call?
That this would be consistent, yes.
Now, turning to the fourth excerpt from the July 25th call, where Ukraine's President Zelensky links the White House meeting to the investigations that President Trump requests. President Zelensky says, I also wanted to thank you for your invitation to visit the United States, specifically Washington, D.C. On the other hand, I also wanted to assure you that we will be very serious about the case and will work on the investigation. Colonel Vindman, when President Zelensky says, on the other hand, would you agree that he's acknowledging a linkage between the White House visit that he mentions in the first sentence and the investigations that he mentions in the second sentence?
It could be taken that way. It seems like a reasonable conclusion.
And if that is the case, that would be consistent with the text message that Ambassador Volker sent to Andrei Yermak right before the call. Is that right?
Seemingly so.
Now, You've testified in your deposition that a White House visit, an Oval Office visit, is very important to President Zelensky. Why is that?
The show of support for President Zelensky, still a brand new president, frankly a new politician on the Ukrainian political scene, looking to establish his bona fides as a regional and maybe even a world leader, would want to have a meeting with the United States, the most powerful country in the world, and Ukraine's most significant benefactor in order to be able to implement his agenda.
It would provide him with some additional legitimacy at home?
Yes.
So just to summarize, in this July 25th call between the presidents of the United States and Ukraine, President Trump demanded a favor of President Zelensky to conduct investigations that both of you acknowledge were for President Trump's political interest, not the national interest, and in return for his promise of a much-desired White House meeting for President Zelensky. Colonel Vindman, is that an accurate summary of the excerpts that we just looked at?
Yes.
Ms. Williams?
Yes.
Colonel Vindman, you immediately reported this call to the NSC lawyers. Why did you do that?
So at this point, I had already been tracking this initially what I would describe as alternative narrative, false narrative, and I was certainly aware of the fact that it was starting to reverberate, gain traction. The fact that it, in the July 10th call, ended up being pronounced by a public official, Ambassador Sondland, had me alerted to this, and I was, subsequent to that report, I was invited to follow up with any other concerns to Mr. Eisenberg.
And we're going to discuss that July 10th meeting in a moment. But when you say alternative false narratives, are you referring to the two investigations that President Trump referenced in the call?
Yes.
Now, at some point, did you also discuss how the written summary of the call record should be handled with the NSC lawyers?
There was, following the report, there was a discussion in the legal shop on the best way to manage the transcript, yes.
What did you understand they concluded?
My understanding is that this was viewed as a sensitive transcript, and to avoid leaks and, if I recall the term properly, or something along the lines of preserve the integrity of the transcript, it should be segregated to a smaller group of folks.
To preserve the integrity of the transcript, what did that mean?
I'm not sure. I mean, it seems like a legal term. I'm not an attorney, but it was, I didn't take it as anything nefarious. I understood that they wanted to keep it in a smaller group.
If there was real interest in preserving the integrity of the transcript, don't you think they would have accepted your correction that Burisma should have been included?
Not necessarily. The way these edits occur, they go through, like everything else, approval process. I made my contribution. It was cleared by Mr. Morrison. Then when I returned it, sometimes that doesn't happen. There are administrative errors. I think that in this case, I didn't see it. When I first saw the transcript without the two substantive items I had attempted to include, I didn't see that as nefarious. I just saw it as, okay, no big deal. You know, these might be meaningful, but it's not that big a deal.
You said two substantive issues. What was the other one?
There was a reference in a section. On page 4, the top paragraph, let me find the right spot. Okay. Yes. You can look into it. Ellipse. There are videos, so what I recall. Or the recordings.
Instead of an ellipses, should have said, to what you heard, that there are recordings?
Correct.
Did you ultimately learn where the call record was put?
I understood that it was being segregated into a separate system, separate secure system.
Why would it be put on a separate secure system?
This is definitely not unprecedented, but at times, if you want to limit access to a smaller group of folks, you put it on the secure system to ensure that a smaller group of people with access to the secure system have it.
But can't you also limit the number of people who can access it on the regular system?
You can do that, but to the best of my recollection, the decision was made, frankly, on the fly after I conveyed my concerns to Mr. Eisenberg. Mr. Ellis came in. He hadn't heard the entire conversation, and when it was mentioned that it was sensitive, it was kind of on the fly decision to just segregate it in this other system.
Mr. Eisenberg and Mr. Ellis are the NSC lawyers?
Correct.
But it was your understanding that it was not a mistake to put it on the highly classified system, is that right?
I'm not sure I understand.
Was it intended to be put on the highly classified system by the lawyers? Or was it a mistake that it was put there?
I think it was intended, but again, it was intended to prevent leaks and to limit access.
Now, you testified, both of you, about the April 21st call a little earlier. And Colonel Vindman, you indicated that you did include in your talking points the idea of Ukraine rooting out corruption, but that President Trump did not mention corruption. I want to go to the White House readout from the April 21st call. And I'm not going to read the whole thing, but you see the highlighted portion where it says root out corruption?
Yes.
So in the end, this readout was false. Is that right?
That's a bit of a, it's not entirely accurate, but I'm not sure if I would describe it as false. It was consistent with U.S. policy, and these items are used as messaging tools also. So a statement that goes out, in addition to, you know, reading out the meeting itself is also a messaging platform to indicate what is important with regards to U.S. policy.
So it is a part of U.S. official policy that Ukraine should root out corruption, even if President Trump did not mention it in that April 21st phone call. Is that right?
Certainly.
And he also did not mention it in the July 25th phone call. Is that right?
Correct.
So even though it was included in his talking points, for the April 21st call, and presumably even though you can't talk about it for the July 21st call, it was not included in either. Is that right?
For the April 21st call...
He did not mention it in either, rather.
Correct.
So when the president says now that he held up security assistance because he was concerned about rooting out corruption in Ukraine, that concern was not expressed in the two phone conversations that he had with President Zelensky earlier this year. Is that right?
Correct.
Now, Ms. Williams, you testified that earlier that after this April 21st call, President Trump asked Vice President Pence to attend President Zelensky's inauguration. Is that right?
That's correct.
And that... on May 13th, you were just informed by the Chief of Staff's office that Vice President Pence will not be going at per request of the President. Is that right?
That's what I was informed, yes.
And you didn't know what had changed from April 21st to May 13th. Is that right?
No, not in terms of that decision.
Well, Colonel Vindman, since you in particular a little bit more perhaps than Ms. Williams, who has a broader portfolio, focuses on Ukraine, I want to ask you if you were aware of the following things that happened from April 21st to May 13th. Were you aware that Ambassador Yovanovitch was abruptly recalled from Ukraine in that time?
Yes.
Were you aware that President Trump...
I'm sorry, to correct it, so she was recalled prior... Let me see... So the notification occurred towards the end of April, and she was finally recalled in May timeframe, I think May 20th, if I recall correctly.
Right. So she learned about it after April 21st, on April 24th, is that right?
Correct.
And were you aware that President Trump had a telephone call with President Putin during this time period in early May?
I was.
And were you aware that Rudy Giuliani had planned a trip to go to Ukraine to pressure the Ukrainians to initiate the two investigations that President Trump mentioned on the July 25th call in this time period?
I was aware that he was traveling there and that he had been promoting the idea of these investigations.
I want to move now to that July 10th meeting that you referenced, Colonel Vindman. What exactly did Ambassador Sondland say when the Ukrainian officials raised the idea of a White House meeting?
As I recall, he referred to specific investigations that Ukrainians would have to deliver in order to get these meetings.
And what happened to
the White House meeting?
What happened to the broader meeting after he made that reference?
Ambassador Bolton very abruptly ended the meeting.
And did you have any conversations with Ambassador Bolton about this meeting?
No, I did not.
Did you follow Ambassador Sondland and the others to the wardroom for a meeting follow-up?
There was a photo opportunity that we leveraged in order to demonstrate U.S. support, so the White House visit demonstrating U.S. support for Ukraine and the new national security advisor, who's a technocrat. And then after that, we went down to a short post-meeting huddle or debrief.
Were the investigations, the specific investigations that Ambassador Sondland referenced in the larger meeting, also discussed in the wardroom meeting?
They were.
And what did Ambassador Sondland say?
Ambassador Sondland referred to investigations into the Biden's Burisma in 2016.
How did you respond, if at all?
I said that this request to conduct these meetings was inappropriate. These investigations was inappropriate and had nothing to do with national security policy.
Was Ambassador Volker in this meeting as well?
I don't recall specifically. I believe he was there for at least a portion of the time. I don't recall if he was there for the whole meeting.
Was this statement made in front of the Ukrainian officials?
I believe there was some discussion prior to the Ukrainians leaving, when it was apparent there was some discord between the senior folks, Ambassador Sondland, and other White House staff, myself, they were asked to step out. So I don't recall if they were there for the entire discussion.
The senior White House staff you're referring to, does that include Fiona Hill, your immediate supervisor at the time?
Correct.
Now, you said you also reported this incident to the NSC lawyers, is that right?
Correct.
And what was their response?
John Eisenberg said that he took notes while I was talking, and he said that he would look into it.
Why did you report this meeting and this conversation to the NSC lawyers?
Because it was inappropriate, and following the meeting, I had a short conversation, following the post-meeting meeting in the wardroom, I had a short conversation with Dr. Hill, and we discussed the idea of needing to report this.
So am I correct, Colonel Vindman, that at least no later than that July 10th meeting, the Ukrainians had understood or at least heard that the Oval Office meeting that they so desperately wanted was conditioned on these specific investigations into Burisma and the 2016 election?
That was the first time I was aware of the Ukrainians being approached directly by a government official.
And directly linking the White House meeting to the investigations?
Correct.
Ms. Williams, you testified that in your opening statement that you attended the September 1st meeting between Vice President Pence and President Zelensky in Warsaw. Is that right?
That's correct.
What was the first thing that President Zelensky asked Vice President Pence about at that meeting?
President Zelensky asked the Vice President about the status of security assistance for Ukraine because he had seen the Politico article and other news reporting that the security assistance was being held.
And you testified in your deposition that in that conversation, President Zelensky emphasized that the military assistance, the security assistance, was not just important to assist Ukraine in fighting a war against Russia, but that it was also symbolic in nature. What did you understand him to mean by that?
President Zelensky explained that more than, or just equally with the financial and physical value of the assistance, that it was the symbolic nature of that assistance that really was the show of U.S. support for Ukraine and for Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity. And I think he was stressing that to the vice president to really underscore the need for the security assistance to be released.
And that if the United States was holding the security assistance, is it also true then that Russia could see that as a sign of weakening U.S. support for Ukraine and take advantage of that?
I believe that's what the President Zelensky was indicating, that any signal or sign that U.S. support was wavering would be construed by Russia as potentially an opportunity for them to strengthen their own hand in Ukraine.
Did Vice President Pence provide a reason for the hold on security assistance to the Ukrainian president in that meeting?
Vice President did not specifically discuss the reason behind the hold, but he did reassure President Zelensky of the strongest U.S. unwavering support for Ukraine, and they talked about the need for European countries to step up and provide more assistance to Ukraine as well.
Did Vice President Pence report back to President Trump on that meeting, to your knowledge?
The Vice President conveyed to President Zelensky that he would follow up with President Trump that evening and convey to President Trump what he had heard from President Zelensky with regard to his efforts to implement reforms in Ukraine. I am aware that the Vice President spoke to President Trump that evening, but I was not privy to the conversation.
Are you also aware, however, that the security assistance hold was not lifted for another 10 days after this meeting?
That's correct.
And am I correct that you didn't learn the reason why the hold was lifted?
That's correct.
Colonel Vindman, you didn't learn a reason why the hold was lifted either, is that right?
Correct.
Colonel Vindman, are you aware that the committees launched an investigation into Ukraine matters on September 9th, 2 days before the hold was lifted?
I am aware, and I was aware.
And on September 10th, the Intelligence Committee requested the whistleblower complaint from the Department of National Intelligence. Are you aware of that?
I don't believe I was aware of that.
Were you aware that the White House was aware of this whistleblower complaint prior to that date?
The first I heard of the whistleblower complaint is, I believe, when the news broke. I was only aware of the committees investigating the hold on security assistance.
So is it accurate to say, Colonel Vindman, that whatever reason that was provided for the hold, including the administrative policies, which would support the hold, would support the security assistance, is that right, to your understanding?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand that.
I was just asking that the administrative policies of President Trump supported the security assistance. Is that your understanding?
So the interagency policy was to support security assistance for Ukraine.
Thank you. I yield back.
Now recognize Ranking Member Nunes or Minority Counsel for 45 minutes.
Thank you, Ms. Williams. Welcome. I want to just establish a few basic facts about your knowledge of Ukraine, Burisma, and the role of the Bidens.
Yes, sir.
You spend an extraordinary amount of your time on Ukraine, correct?
Ukraine is one of the countries in my portfolio. I would not say an extraordinary amount of time, but certainly the Vice President has engaged on Ukraine policy quite a bit in my 8 months.
And it's in your portfolio.
That's correct.
First off, were you aware in September of 2015, then U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Jeffrey Pyatt, publicly called for an investigation into Slushevsky, the president of Burisma? Were you aware of these public statements?
No, not at the time.
You are today, though.
I've since heard them, yes.
Did you know of anti-Trump efforts by various Ukrainian officials as well as Alexander Chalupa, a DNC consultant?
No, I was not aware.
Did you know about the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State Kent's concerns about potential conflict of interest into Hunter Biden sitting on the board of Burisma?
I did not work on Ukraine policy during that time frame, so I've become aware of it through...
In the last year or so.
I've become aware of it through Mr. Kent's testimony through this process.
Did you know that financial records show a Ukrainian natural gas company, Burisma, routed more than $3 million to American accounts tied to Hunter Biden?
No, I was not aware.
Until you prepared for this hearing?
Until others have been testifying in more detail on those issues, that's correct.
You've been following it more closely.
Correct.
Did you know that Burisma's American legal representatives met with Ukrainian officials just days after Vice President Biden forced the firing of the country's chief prosecutor?
Again, sir, I was not working on Ukraine policy during that time.
Yeah, and none of these are trick questions. I'm just trying to get through them.
I understand. Yeah.
Did you know that Burisma lawyers pressured the State Department in February 2016 after the raid and month before the firing of Shokin, and that they invoked Hunter Biden's name as a reason to intervene?
I was not aware.
Did you know that Joe Biden called Ukrainian President Poroshenko at least three times in February 2016 after the president and owner of Burisma's home was raided on February 2nd by the state prosecutor's office?
Not at the time. Again, I've become aware of that through this proceeding.
Thank you, Ms. Williams. Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, I'm going to ask you same questions just to establish some basic facts about your knowledge about Ukraine, Burisma, and the role of the Bidens. In September 2015, U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine Jeffrey Pyatt publicly called for an investigation into Sleshevsky, the president of Burisma. Were you aware of these public statements?
I wasn't aware of them at the time.
When did you become aware of them?
During the course of the testimony and the depositions after this impeachment inquiry began.
Did you know of anti-Trump efforts by various Ukrainian government officials as well as Alexander Chalupa, a DNC consultant?
I'm not aware of any of these interference efforts.
Did you know about Deputy Assistant Secretary of State Kent's concerns about potential conflicts of interest with Hunter Biden sitting on the board of Burisma?
The only thing I'm aware of is pertains to his deposition.
Did you know that financial records show a Ukrainian natural gas company, Burisma, routed more than $3 million to the American accounts tied to Hunter Biden?
I'm not aware of this fact.
Until recently?
I guess I didn't independently look into it. I'm just not aware of what kind of payments Mr. Biden may have received. This is not something I'm aware of.
Did you know that Burisma's American legal representatives met with Ukrainian officials just days after Vice President Biden forced the firing of the country's chief prosecutor?
I'm not aware of these meetings.
Did you know that Burisma lawyers pressured the State Department in February 2016 after the raid and a month before the firing of Shokin, that they invoked Hunter Biden's name as a reason to intervene?
I'm not aware of any of these facts.
Did you know that Joe Biden called Ukrainian President Poroshenko at least three times in February 2016 after the president and owner of Burisma's home was raided on February 2nd by the state prosecutor's office?
I'm aware of the fact that Vice President Biden was very engaged on Ukraine and had numerous engagements. That's what I'm aware of.
Ms. Williams and Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, as you may or may not know, this committee has spent nearly 3 years conducting various investigations, starting with the Russia collusion hoax, FISA abuse, Democratic hysteria over the lack of collusion in the Mueller report, and now this impeachment charade. One of the most concerning things regarding all of these investigations is the amount of classified or otherwise sensitive information I read in the press that derive either from this committee or sources in the administration. To be clear, I'm not accusing either one of you of leaking information. However, given that you are the first witnesses who actually have some firsthand knowledge of the president's call by listening in on July 25th, it's imperative to the American public's understanding of the events that we get a quick matters out of the few matters out of the way first. Ms. Williams, let me just go to you first. For the purposes of the following questions, I'm only asking about the time period between from July 25th to September 25th.
Okay.
Did you discuss the July 25th phone call between President Trump and President Zelensky or any matters associated with the phone call with any members of the press?
No.
To be clear, you never discussed these matters with the New York Times, the Washington Post, Politico, CNN, or any other media outlet?
No, I did not.
Did you ask or encourage any individual to share the substance of the July 25th phone call or any matter associated with the call with any member of the press?
I did not.
Do you know of any individual who discussed the substance of the July 25th phone call or matter associated with the call with any member of the press?
No, I do not.
Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, the same questions for you. Did you discuss the July 25th phone call between President Trump and President Zelensky or any matter associated with the phone call with any member of the press?
I did not.
Just to be clear, you did not discuss this with the New York Times, the Washington Post, Politico, CNN, or any other media outlet?
I did not.
Did you ask or encourage any individual to share the substance of the July 25th phone call or any matter associated with the call with any member of the press?
I did not.
Do you know of any individual who discussed the substance of the July 25th phone call or any matter associated with the call with any member of the press?
We have an NSC press shop, and they field any of these types of questions. I do not engage with the press at all.
Let me ask the question again. Do you know of any individual who discussed the substance of the July 25th phone call or any matter associated with the call with any member of the press?
We have an NSC press shop whose job is to engage on any of these types of questions. I am not aware, but it is possible and likely that the press shop would have had would field these types of questions.
Right. But the question the question is, do you know any individual? Do you personally know any individual who discussed the substance of the July 25th phone call or any matter associated with the call with any member of the press?
Thank you, Ranking Member, for clarifying. I do not.
Thank you. Ms. Williams, did you discuss the July 25th phone call with anyone outside the White House on July 25th or July 26th, and if so, with whom?
No, I did not discuss the call with anyone outside or inside the White House.
Ms. Williams, during your time on the NSC, have you ever accessed a colleague's work computer without their prior authorization or approval?
I have not. Just to clarify, I'm in the office of the Vice President, so not on the NSC.
Right, but representing
the Vice President.
No, I have
not. No.
Thank you for that clarification. Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, did you discuss the July 25th phone call with anyone outside the White House on July 25th or the 26th? And if so, with whom?
Yes, I did. My core function is to coordinate U.S. government policy, interagency policy, and I spoke to two individuals with regards to providing some sort of readout of the call.
Two individuals that were not in the White House?
Not in the White House, cleared U.S. government officials with appropriate need to know.
And what agencies were these officials with?
Department of State. Department of State Deputy Assistant Secretary George Kent, who is responsible for the portfolio Eastern Europe, including Ukraine, and a individual from the office of an individual in the intelligence community.
As you know, the intelligence community has 17 different agencies. What agency was this individual from?
If I could interject here. We don't want to use these proceedings.
It's our time,
I know,
Mr. Chair.
But we need to protect the whistleblower.
Please stop.
I want to make sure that there's no effort to out the whistleblower through the use of these proceedings. If the witness has a good faith belief
that this may reveal the identity of the whistleblower. That is not the purpose that we are here for, and I want to advise the witness accordingly.
Mr. Vindman, you testified in your deposition that you did not know the whistleblower.
Ranking member, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, please.
Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, you testified in the deposition that you did not know who the whistleblower was or is.
I do not know who the whistleblower is. That is.
Well, how is it possible for you to name these people and then out the whistleblower?
Per the advice of my counsel, I've been advised not to answer specific questions about members of the intelligence community.
Are you aware that this is the intelligence committee that's conducting an impeachment hearing?
Of course I am.
Wouldn't the appropriate place for you to come to testify would be the intelligence committee about someone within the intelligence community?
Ranking member, per the advice of my counsel and the instructions from the chairman, I've been advised not to provide any specifics on who I've spoken to with inside the intelligence community. What I can offer is that these were properly cleared individuals, or was a properly cleared individual with a need to know.
Well, this is, you can plead the fifth. But you're here to answer questions, and you're here under subpoena. So you can either answer the question or you can plead the fifth.
On behalf of my client, we are following the rule of the committee, the rule of the chair with regard to this issue. And this does not call for an answer that is invoking the fifth or any theoretical issue like that. We're following the ruling of the chair.
What, Counselor, what ruling is that?
If I could interject, counsel is correct. Whistleblower has the right, statutory right to anonymity. These proceedings will not be used to out the whistleblower.
And I've advised my client accordingly, and he's going to follow the ruling of the chair. If there's a alternative or you want to work something out with the chair, that's up to you, Mr. Nunes.
Well, we've attempted to subpoena the whistleblower to sit for a deposition. The chair has tabled that motion and then has been unwilling to recognize those motions over the last few days of this impeachment inquisition process. Well, that I'll go to Mr. Castor.
Thank you, Ranking Member Nunes. The call transcript as published on September 25th is complete and accurate. Will both of you attest to that, Ms. Williams?
I didn't take a word-for-word accounting. When I first saw the publicly released version, it looked substantively correct to me.
And Colonel Vindman?
I certainly would describe it as substantively correct.
In your testimony, your deposition, you said very accurate?
Correct.
Okay. And you flagged a couple edits, Colonel Vindman. I think you had Burisma on page four.
Yep.
Where President Zelensky was talking about the company mentioned in the issue?
I'm sorry, could you say that question?
I believe in your testimony you explained that you offered an edit that on page 4 of the transcript that was ultimately published, you thought President Zelensky mentioned the word Burisma.
Oh, I had it in my notes. I know that's what he said, yes.
Okay. And Ms. Williams, and that was on page 4, correct?
Correct.
And Ms. Williams, I believe after your deposition you went back and checked your notes and you had President Zelensky using the term Burisma as well. Is that correct?
That's correct.
But that came up on a different part of the transcript than what Colonel Vindman was relating to, correct?
Yes, I believe so.
Yours came up on page 5, and it would have been in substitution for the word case?
That's right. That's where I have it in my notes.
Okay. Colonel Vindman, we've had some discussion earlier today and also at your deposition about whether the president had a demand for President Zelensky. I suggested to you in the deposition that the president's words are, in fact, ambiguous. And he uses some phrases that certainly could be characterized as hedging. On page 3, in the first paragraph, he talks about whatever you can do. He talks about if that's possible. On page 4, he mentions if you could speak to him. He talked about the attorney general. or Rudy Giuliani. And then at the end of the first paragraph on page 4, he says, whatever you can do. The president also says, you know, if you can look into it. And I asked you during your deposition whether you saw or acknowledged the fact that certain people could read that to be ambiguous.
And I said, correct, yes.
And I believe you said, I think people want to hear what they have already preconceived. Is that what you testified?
Actually, if I could ask for just a page cite.
256.
256,
yeah.
And a line. Thank you. Just a minute, please.
And
just a minute, please.
Okay,
we got the page.
Okay. And then you went on to say, yeah, you agreed with me. You said, yeah, I guess you could interpret it different ways. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Turning attention to the preparation of the transcript, that followed the ordinary process, correct?
I think it followed the appropriate process in terms of making sure that eventually it came around for clearances, for accuracy,
okay.
But it was in a different system. So
well, I'll get to that in a second. That relates to the storage of it. You had some concerns. Mr. Morrison articulated his concerns about if the transcript was leaked out. And I think both you and Mr. Morrison agreed that it needed to be protected.
Just a correction. I don't think it was Mr. Morrison. It was Mr. Eisenberg. Right?
Mr. Morrison testified at his deposition.
Okay, we don't have that in front of us. If you can give us that, we'll take a look.
Yeah, I think in this, but I could say for myself, the concerns about leaks seemed valid, and I wasn't particularly critical. I thought this was sensitive, and I was not going to question the attorney's judgment on that.
Right. And even on the code word server, you had access to it.
Yes.
So at no point in time during the course of your official duties were you denied access to this information?
Correct.
Is that correct? Ms. Williams, I want to turn to you for a moment. And you testified that you believe the transcript is complete and accurate, other than the one issue you mentioned?
Yes, substantively accurate, yes.
Now, did you express any concerns to anyone in your office about what you heard on the call?
My supervisor was in listening on the call as well. So because he had heard the same information, I did not feel a need to have a further conversation with him about it.
And you never had any concerns with anyone else in the vice president's office?
I did not discuss the call further with anyone in the vice president's office.
Okay. So you didn't flag it for the chief of staff or the vice president's counsel or anyone of that sort?
Again, my immediate supervisor, Lieutenant General Kellogg, was in the room with me.
Right. So. And after the call, did you and General Kellogg ever discuss the contents of the call?
We did not.
Okay. Now, in the run-up to the meeting in Warsaw, the vice president was meeting with President Zelensky September 1st in Warsaw. You were involved with the preparation of the vice president's briefing materials?
I was.
And did you flag for the vice president this parts of the call that had concerned you?
No, we did not include the call transcript in the trip briefing book. We don't normally include previous calls in trip briefing books.
And so just wondering, if the concerns were so significant, how come nobody on the vice president's staff at least alerted him to the issue that President Zelensky might be on edge about something that had been mentioned on the 725 call?
Again, my supervisor had been in the call with me. And I ensured that the vice president had access to the transcript in the moment on that day. As we were preparing for the September meeting with President Zelensky, the more immediate issue at hand was 2 days prior, the news had broken about the hold on the security assistance. So we were much more focused on the discussion that was likely to occur about the hold on security assistance for that meeting.
And to your recollection, you were in the meeting with President Zelensky and Vice President Pence?
I was.
And Burisma didn't come up, or the Bidens, or any of these investigations?
No, it did not.
Colonel Vindman, you testified that the president has long-standing concerns about corruption in Ukraine, correct?
I don't recall, but there are concerns. There are broad concerns about corruption, yes.
But you would agree that if the U.S. is giving hundreds of millions of dollars to a foreign nation, that has a corruption problem. That's certainly something that the U.S. government officials and the president would want to be concerned about?
Yes.
And if a foreign country has a problem with oligarchs taking money, taking U.S. taxpayer dollars, that's something that the president ought to be concerned about in advance of dispensing the aid?
Yes.
And I believe you did testify that corruption is endemic in Ukraine?
Correct.
Are you also aware of the president's skepticism of foreign aid generally?
I am.
And it's something that he's made part of his priorities to make sure that U.S. foreign aid is spent wisely?
That is correct.
And you're also aware the president has concerns about burden sharing among our allies?
Yes.
And with respect to Ukraine, he was very interested and engaged in seeing if there was a possibility for our European allies to step up and contribute more?
Yes, I think that would be in the context of military assistance. In terms of burden sharing, the European Union provides over $15 billion.
Okay.
Has provided since 2014.
Okay, but you are aware of the president's concern of burden sharing, right?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Turning our attention specifically to the company of Burisma, Mykola Zochevsky, the co-founder of Burisma, is one of Ukraine's largest natural gas producers, correct?
That is my understanding, yes.
And it's been subject to numerous investigations over the years.
I'm not aware of, I guess I couldn't point to specific investigations, but there is a pattern of questionable dealings and questions about corruption.
Zochevsky had served as the Minister of Ecology during President Yanukovych's tenure?
I came to learn that is correct, yes.
And are you aware, and George Kent testified a little bit about this last week, that under the Obama administration, the U.S. government encouraged Ukraine to investigate whether Zochevsky used his government position to grant himself or Burisma exploration licenses? Are you aware of that?
Yeah, I would defer to George Kent. He's a fount of knowledge on Ukraine, much deeper knowledge than I have. And if he attested to that, then I'd take his word for it.
And he testified that the U.S., along with the United Kingdom, was engaged in trying to recoup about $23 million in taxpayer dollars from Zochevsky and the Burisma entity?
I understand he testified that, yes.
Okay. And Mr. Kent also testified that the investigation was moving along, and then all of a sudden there was a bribe paid, and the investigation went away. Did you hear him mention that?
I heard him mention that. These are events that occurred before my time, so frankly, beyond what he said, I don't know much more.
Fair enough. Right around the time the bribe was paid, the company sought to bolster their board. Are you aware that they tapped some luminaries for their corporate board?
Certainly, I learned that at some point, yes.
Including the president of Poland, I believe?
Yes.
And Hunter Biden?
Yes, I came to learn that as well.
And are you aware of any specific experience Hunter Biden has in the Ukrainian corporate governance world?
I don't know much about Mr. Hunter Biden.
And we talked a little bit about, at your deposition, about whether Mr. Biden was qualified to serve on this board. I believe you acknowledged that apparently he was not, in fact, qualified.
As far as I can tell, he didn't seem to be, but like I said, I don't know his qualifications.
Okay. And Ms. Williams, I want to turn our attention to the inaugural trip. At one point, the Vice President and the Vice President's office was focusing on attending that, correct?
That's right.
And it's somewhat complicated because as I understand it, the White House doesn't want the president and the vice president to be out of the country at the same time?
Yes, that's correct.
And during the time frame, the president was in Japan. I believe he was in Japan May 24th to 28th. And then he returned to Europe for the D-Day ceremonies, June 2nd to 7th. And I think you told us that there was a window you provided of 4 days at the end of May, that if the vice president was going to attend the inauguration, it had to be the 29th, 30th, 31st, or 1st?
Our embassy in Kyiv had
been in discussions with the Ukrainian, with President Zelensky's team. And as we had learned, obviously, the Ukrainian parliament was not going to come back into session until mid-May, and so we wouldn't know formally what the date would be. But we understood that the initial thinking was that they were looking at dates at the end of May. And so honing in on that time frame, we were aware of President Trump's planned travel on either end. And so that's why we advised the Ukrainians that if Vice President Pence were to be able to participate, the only really available days would be May 30th, May 31st, or June 1st.
Okay. And before the Vice President travels to a foreign nation, you have to send the Secret Service, do advance work, book hotels, and it's a relatively involved preparation experience, right?
That's correct.
Do you know if the Secret Service ever deployed, booked hotels or anything of that sort?
My understanding is that our advance team was looking into those preparations, including hotel availability, and we were trying to determine when it would be appropriate to send out Secret Service and other advanced personnel in order to lay groundwork for a trip. But because we weren't sure yet when the date would be, we hesitated to send those
okay.
officials out.
But ultimately, the Secret Service, as I understand it, did not deploy.
I don't believe they did, no.
Okay. And the President Zelensky's inauguration was May 20th, if I'm not mistaken?
Yes, that's correct.
And you had about 4 days' notice?
In the end, the Ukrainian parliament decided on May 16th to set the date for May
okay.
20th. That's correct.
So you would acknowledge that that made it quite difficult for the vice president and the whole operation to mobilize and get over to Ukraine, correct?
It would have been, but we had already stopped the trip planning by that point.
And when did that happen?
Stopping the trip planning?
Yeah.
On May 13th.
Okay. And how did you hear about that?
I was called by a colleague in the vice president's chief of staff's office and told to stop the trip planning.
Okay, and as I understand it, it was the assistant to the chief of staff?
That's correct.
Okay, and so you didn't hear about it from General Kellogg or the chief of staff or...
Correct.
Or the president or the vice president. You heard about it from Mr. Short's assistant?
That's right.
And did you have any knowledge of the reasoning for stopping the trip?
I asked my colleague why we should stop trip planning and why the vice president would not be attending, and I was informed that the president had decided the vice president would not attend the inauguration.
Okay, but do you know why the president decided?
No, she did not have that information.
Okay. And ultimately, the vice president went to Canada for a USMCA event.
That's right.
During this window of time, correct?
Correct.
So it's entirely conceivable that the president decided that he wanted the vice president to go to Canada on behalf of USMCA instead of doing anything else, correct?
I'm really not in a position to speculate what the motivations were behind the president's decision.
Well, you know the vice president's done quite a bit of USMCA events, correct?
Absolutely, yes,
okay.
sir.
And are you aware of whether the anyone at the State Department inquired with your office about the vice president's availability for the trip to Canada?
For the trip, at what point?
Early May, maybe May 8th.
I was not involved in the trip planning for Canada. Mm-hmm. One of my colleagues who covers Western Hemisphere was in charge
okay.
of that, so I'm not aware of specific
okay.
requests about
okay.
the vice president's availability. I was aware from my colleague who was planning that trip that we had competing trips potentially for the
okay.
same window, but I was told that the Ukraine trip would take priority.
Okay, but ultimately you don't know.
I don't know about the Canada trip.
You don't know the reason as to why the vice president was sent to Canada for a USMCA event instead of going to the Ukraine?
I would say I don't know the reason behind why the president directed the vice president not to go to Ukraine. I can't speak to the motivations or about the Canada trip.
Okay. Colonel Vindman, I'd like to turn a little bit to the July 10th meeting in Ambassador Bolton's office. And the subsequent post meeting in the wardroom. Who all was in the July 10th meeting, to the best of your recollection?
Are we talking about the wardroom, or are we talking about the actual meeting with Ambassador Bolton?
We'll start with the first meeting in the ambassador's office.
So from the U.S. side, we had Ambassador Bolton, Dr. Hill. I believe there was another a special assistant to the president. Wells Griffith was in there,
mm-hmm.
From our, and myself, from the Ukrainians.
From the Ukrainians, oh, sorry.
Yeah, for the Ukrainian side, we had Alexander Danyluk, Andriy Yermak and I think Alexander Danyluk's advisor, Alexei Semeny.
Okay. And you testified that you couldn't recall exactly why Ambassador Bolton stopped the meeting short, and you only learned it subsequently talking to Dr. Fiona Hill?
Yeah, I noted that, you know, it ended up abruptly, but I didn't, frankly, you know, I didn't exactly know why.
And in the Bolton meeting, you don't remember Ambassador Sondland using the word Biden?
He did not. Okay. As far, to the best of my recollection, I don't think he did.
And then the group decamped to take a photo, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So the general feeling of the group was a positive one at that time, even though it may have ended abruptly.
I think Ambassador Bolton was exceptionally qualified. He understood the strategic communications opportunity of having a photo, and we prompted him to before we completely adjourned, to see if he was willing to do a photo, and he did.
Okay, so you went out to West Executive Ave or wherever in the White House, and you took a photo. I think you said you took it?
I certainly took a couple of them, yes.
Okay. And in the photo is Secretary Perry, Ambassador Bolton, Ambassador Volker.
That's right. Yeah.
Mr. Danyluk and Mr. Yermak?
Yes, and I apologize. When I was running through the U.S. side, of course, Ambassador Bolton, Volker, and Sondland were there, and Secretary Perry was there.
Okay. Now, you testified that before the July 10th meeting, you had developed concerns about the narrative, you know, involving Rudy Giuliani. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And had you heard, like, a firsthand account from anyone on the inside, or had you just been following news accounts?
I certainly was following news accounts, and that's from the Ukrainian side, Ukrainian press, and U.S. press.
Okay. And then
my colleagues in the interagency also were concerned about this, as this had started in the March time frame, kind of emanating from the John Solomon story all the way through. So there had been ongoing conversations. So several different sources, counsel.
Okay. And so when Ambassador Sondland mentioned the investigations, you sort of had a little bit of a clue of what the issue was?
Oh, definitely.
Okay. And then you took the photo, a very nice photo, and then you went to the wardroom?
Correct.
And do you remember, you know, I think you conceded to us that you had a hard time remembering exactly what was said in the wardroom. Again, it's 4 months ago. It's hard to be precise about whether Sondland, what specific words he used, whether he used Burisma, 2016, investigations.
I believe it's in the deposition, the three elements, Burisma, Biden's, and the 2016 elections were all mentioned.
In the wardroom?
Correct.
I think we can maybe go back to this, but I think on page 64 of your testimony, you told us that you don't remember him using 2016 in the wardroom.
I believe that I actually followed up, and because this question was asked multiple times,
uh-huh.
I said that all three elements were in there. So
okay, so
picked out
when we asked the question, it sort of refreshed your recollection.
Yes, I guess that's
okay.
A term now.
There was some discussion of, you know, whether when Mr. Morrison took over the portfolio for Dr. Hill, whether you were sidelined at all. Did you feel like you were?
So I certainly was excluded or didn't participate in the trip to Ukraine, Moldova, Belarus.
Okay.
At the end of August. And I wasn't initially, before it changed from a POTUS trip to a vice president trip to Warsaw, I wasn't participating in that one. So I didn't miss that, no.
Did you express any concerns to Mr. Morrison about why you weren't included on those trips?
So Mr. Morrison, I was on leave. I was supposed to be on leave from the 3rd of August through about the 16th or so of August,
mm-hmm.
And he called me and asked me to return. There was obviously a high-priority travel to the region. He needed my assistance to help plan for it. And in asking me to return early from leave, which I take infrequently, I assumed that I'd be gone on the trip. So when I was after returning from leave early, when I was told I wasn't going, I inquired about it, correct?
Okay. And what feedback did he give you?
He initially told me that the aircraft that was acquired, the Milair, was too small and there wasn't enough room.
Had you ever had any discussions with Mr. Morrison about concerns that he or Dr. Hill had with your judgment?
Did I ever have any conversations with Mr. Morrison about it? No.
Okay. Did Mr. Morrison ever express concerns to you that he thought maybe you weren't following the chain of command in all instances?
He did not.
Did Dr. Hill or Mr. Morrison ever ask you questions about whether you were trying to access information outside of your lane?
They did not.
Another, you know, aspect of the Ukraine portfolio that you were not a part of were some of the communications Mr. Morrison was having with Ambassador Taylor?
Correct.
And did you ever express concern that he was leaving you off those calls?
Well, certainly it was concerning. He had just come on board. He didn't have the, he wasn't steeped in all the items that we were working on, including the policy that we had developed over the preceding months. And I thought I could contribute to that, to his, to the performance of his duties.
Okay. When you were, you went to Ukraine for the inauguration?
Correct.
At any point during that trip, did Mr. Danyluk offer you a position of defense minister with the Ukrainian government?
He did.
And how many times did he do that?
I believe it was three times.
And do you have any reason why he asked you to do that?
I don't know, but every single time I dismissed it. Upon returning, I notified my chain of command and the appropriate counterintelligence folks about the offer.
Ukraine's a country that's experienced a war with Russia. Certainly their Minister of Defense is a pretty key position.
Yeah.
For the Ukrainians, President Zelensky, Mr. Danyluk, to bestow that honor on you, at least asking you. I mean, that was a big honor, correct?
I think it would be a great honor, and frankly, I'm aware of service members that have left service to help nurture the developing democracies in that part of the world, certainly in the Baltics. Former officers, and if I recall correctly, it was an Air Force officer that became Minister of Defense. But I'm an American. I came here when I was a toddler, and I immediately dismissed these offers, did not entertain them.
When he made this offer to you initially, did you leave the door open? Was there a reason that he had to come back and ask a second and third time, or was he just trying to convince you?
Yeah, counsel, you know what? It's the whole notion is rather comical that I was being asked to consider whether I'd want to be the Minister of Defense. I did not leave the door open at all.
Okay.
But it is pretty funny for a Lieutenant Colonel of the United States Army, which really isn't not that senior, to be offered that illustrious a position.
When he made this offer to you, was he speaking in English or Ukrainian?
Oh, Mr. Danyluk is a absolutely flawless English speaker. He's speaking in English.
Okay.
And just to be clear, there were two other staff officers, Embassy Kiev staff officers, that were sitting next to me when this offer was made.
Okay. Yeah. And who were they?
So one of them you may have met. It was Mr. David Holmes, and the other one was, I don't know, I mean, I guess I could, it's another Foreign Service officer, Keith Bean.
Okay. We met Mr. Holmes last Friday evening.
I understand.
Yeah.
Delightful fellow.
And you said when you returned to the United States, you papered it up, given your you know, with SCI clearance, whenever a foreign government makes a overture like that, you have to, you paper it up and you tell your chain of command?
I did, but I also don't know if I fully entertained it as a legitimate offer. I was just making sure that I did the right thing in terms of reporting, yes.
Okay. And did any of your supervisors, Dr. Hill at the time, or Dr. Kupperman or Ambassador Bolton ever follow up with you about that? It's rather significant.
Yeah.
You know, the Ukrainians offered you the post of defense minister. You know, did you tell anyone in your chain of command about it?
After I spoke to, and I believe it, the deputy, our deputy senior director, John Erath, was there, Once I mentioned it to both of them, I don't believe there was ever a follow-up discussion.
Okay. So it never came up with Dr. Kupperman or Dr. Hill?
Following that conversation I had with Dr. Hill, I don't believe there was a subsequent conversation, and I don't recall ever having a conversation with Dr. Kupperman about it.
Okay, and did you brief Director Morrison when he came on board?
No, I completely forgot about it.
Okay, and subsequent to the May trip, did Mr. Danny Luke ever ask you to reconsider? Were there any other offers?
No.
Okay. When he visited for the July 10th meeting in... with Ambassador Bolton, did it come up again?
It never came up again.
Okay. And did you ever think that possibly if this information was, got out, that it might create at least the perception of a conflict, that the Ukrainians thought so highly of you to offer you the defense ministry post, on one hand, but on the other hand, you're responsible for Ukrainian policy at the National Security Council?
So, frankly, it'd be it's more important about what my American leadership, my American chain of command, thinks than any of the, and this is, these are honorable people. I'm not sure if he meant it as a joke or not, but it's much more important what my civilian White House National Security Council chain of command thinks more so than anybody else. And frankly, if they were concerned about me being able to continue my duties,
of course,
they would have brought that to my attention. Dr. Hill stayed on for several more months, and we could continue to work to advance U.S. policy.
Okay. And during the times relevant of the committee's investigation, did you have any communications with Mr. Yarmak or Danny Luke outside of the July 10th meeting?
I recall a courtesy note from Mr. Yarmak within days of his return to July, in which he wanted to preserve an open channel communication, and I said, please feel free to contact me with any concerns.
And were you following this? There's sort of two tracks. Ambassador Taylor walked us through it during his testimony last Wednesday. He called it a regular channel, and then he called it an irregular but not outlandish channel with Ambassador Sondland and Ambassador Volker. Were you tracking the Sondland and Volker channel during this time period?
Yeah, so I'm trying to recall at which point I became aware of Ambassador Sondland. Certainly I was aware of the fact that they were working together. Ambassador Sondland, Ambassador Volker, and Secretary Perry were working together to advance U.S. policy interests that were in support of what had been agreed to. But I didn't really learn, like I said, until the July 10th. There may have been a slightly earlier point. I recall a meeting in which Ambassador Bolton facilitated a meeting between Ambassador Volker and Ambassador Bolton in the June time frame. And there may have been some discussion about this external channel. But
okay.
I frankly didn't become aware of these particular U.S. government officials being involved in this alternate track until July 10th.
Okay. And I think we had some discussion that, Mr. Giuliani was promoting a negative narrative about the Ukraine, and certain officials were trying to help the president understand that with Zelensky, it was a new day and Ukraine's going to be different. Is that your understanding?
That is correct. That is exactly what was being reported by the intelligence community, by the policy channels within the NSC, and the conservative voices of the various people that have actually met with them, including foreign officials.
And to the extent that you're aware of what Ambassador Sondland's goals were here and Ambassador Volker's goals were here, you think they were just trying to do the best they could and try to advocate in the best interest of the United States?
That is what I believed, and that is what I still believe, frankly.
And so to the extent Mr. Giuliani may have had differing views, they were trying to help him understand that it was time to change those views?
I think they were trying to bring him into the tent and have him kind of support the direction that we had settled on.
And you never conferred with Mr. Giuliani?
No.
You never had any meetings, phone calls, or anything of that sort?
I did not.
And did you have any...
I only know him as New York's finest mayor.
America's mayor.
America's mayor.
And did you have any discussions, communications during this relevant time period with the president?
I've never had any contact with the President of the United States.
My time's expired, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
I thank the gentleman. We're going to now move to the five-minute member rounds. Are you good to go forward, or do you need a break?
I think we'll elect to take a short break.
Okay. Let's try to take a 5 or 10 minute break, and we will resume with the 5 minute rounds. If I could ask the audience and members to please allow the witnesses to leave the room first. Committee is in recess.